Okay, we may make a start. Our dessert offering for the seminar is the magic pudding. Hopefully it keeps us excited. I'm sure it will, given the quality and the calibre of our speakers. Now, I'll give a brief introduction on the three speakers. I'm sure you all know all about them. Jeff Atkins, 30 years plus, Finity, and I'll leave it at that, maybe. Sue Freeman, at Finity now as well, previously in a lot of government experience, and I'm sure a lot of you have come across Sue in various forums. And Raj, also at Finity, over 20 years of experience as well. And I might just let them kick it off then.
The last presentation I did, the bio took so long there was no time for the presentation. So, the magic pudding. Some of you may have heard Finity present on the magic pudding before at previous forums and have also written about the magic pudding. Being dodgy business networks that are targeting CTP and motor insurance and actually quite successfully and impacting costs in both those areas. So we've coined the term magic pudding because it's like something that never runs out, like the magic pudding of Norman Lindsay's book. And the thing that you need to be aware of is that it's your money that we're talking about that seems to be endlessly leaking out into these dodgy networks. So this is something that Finity's taken an interest in for quite a while. We've been monitoring claim farming as it's impacting CTP, and more recently we've been looking at other business models and whether they are related or different business models targeting motor insurance. And so we're talking about both today, and we're giving you a little potted history of the enormous efforts that have taken place in the United Kingdom that many of you might know, where similar problems have had a huge impact in both CTP and motor insurance, and a long battle to try and wrestle control of these networks. So ultimately it is the policyholder that pays because it ends up impacting premiums because it has such a significant effect on your costs. So how does it work in CTP? And I think certainly for those in New South Wales and increasingly in other states, you've probably all experienced this personally, that there are companies out there that are cold calling and they're ringing and they may say, I know you were in an accident last Wednesday on the Pacific Highway, or they may say, do you or anyone you know have been in a car accident at all? Someone you know must have been, or probably you have been at some time. So they make all these promises, and increasingly they say, you've got to act quickly. There's this special offer, there's this pot of money. It's got your name on it, but you've got to sign right now. They'll even sometimes follow up with a home visit. But essentially what they're trying to do is trying to get you to lodge a CTP claim for an injury. Whether you were actually injured or not is not strictly relevant. They'll say, we can sort that one out. But lodge a claim and we'll refer you to a certain solicitor who will look after everything for you from then on. So obviously some money must have changed hands at some point there. Very hard to pin down, and it's quite certainly illegal in most states for a solicitor to take a referral fee for a compensation claim. Nevertheless, these networks are working. So some money is changing hands somewhere. The next step that might happen is that the legal firm might suggest that it would be a good idea if you go to a certain doctor or health practitioner. Not that you have to, but if you do, things might go easier. Sometimes in those cases that might result in some over-servicing and it might result in some exaggeration of injuries. So you can end up with a claim with certificates for injuries that may or may not really be there at all and treatment that you may or may not need. So here's some business relationships, presumably, between the legal firm and the health firm. Presumably there's some arrangement, or are they just doing it for love? Don't know. Meanwhile, the CTP insurer gets their floods of claims coming in every year, amongst which are some of these. Do you have a way of identifying them? Do you know what the flags are? Do you have a different way of dealing with them if you're suspicious that these claims are coming in with exaggerated or possibly even fraudulent injuries? if you do know how to identify them, what do you do about it? We know that to get a prosecution for fraud is extremely difficult. So very often I think we find it's easier to just pay a small amount of go-away money to get rid of them than to really get to the bottom of it. Therefore, the networks are working and continue to thrive. In excuse my throat. In motor, and we're seeing this increasingly, thanks, I think it's just, yeah. Too cool. So in motor, a different sort of strategy takes place, and are they linked? We'll come to that later, but you're seeing them certainly all over Sydney and probably in other states, these rental vehicles that advertise that why should you, the not-at-fault driver, be without a vehicle while your vehicle's being repaired because some idiot ran into you. And in fact, you could have a like-for-like replacement, or in fact, you could actually have a luxury vehicle and you just sign here and don't worry, the insurer will pay. We'll look after it. So we're seeing with those business networks that inflated costs of hire, significantly inflated costs, and sometimes linked in with the repairer, much longer durations to get the vehicle repaired. So you're hiring a car at high cost for much longer than would normally be the case. It's not even the motor insurer's customer. It's the not-at-fault driver. So the motor insurer has difficult ability to control what that party is going to do and even to contact them and avoid those costs. They don't find out about it till after it's happened. So that's the basic model. It's a tangled web. And I'll just point to the money tree because that's your money. And it's a bit hard to track down who exactly is getting what cut, when and how. It's all very well hidden. And investigations have failed to actually show up. For example, we haven't seen solicitors deregistered for taking referral fees, and yet these networks are thriving, so not quite sure. They're well hidden. But various parties, the tow trucks, the repairers, solicitors and medico and the legal advisors and the medical, all involved in exaggerating claims for their own benefit. So with this cold calling, where do they get your number? I think I mentioned sometimes they do seem to have details. They'll know that an accident happened. They'll know when and where. And great speculation about how they know that. One thought is it's leaking from the motor insurers themselves, who do know the details of an accident. And so that's something insurers should really be concerned about and conduct investigations to see. Maybe it's the tow truck drivers, maybe it's police, maybe it's spotters. And as we've mentioned, sometimes the calls are quite random. In fact, strangely, I mean, most people we know have had one. Who here has received one of these calls? Okay, well, it's not the majority. And in all this time I've been really interested in this, I never got one. I kind of started to feel a bit, you know, like, what's wrong with me? But last Saturday while I was out, an extremely aggressive woman apparently rang and spoke to my daughter and said that she's calling about your mum's car accident. And my daughter went, has my mum been in an accident? They said, yes, she has, and she was injured. And my daughter went, what, when, where is she? She said, oh, no, some time ago she was injured in a car accident. I'm ringing to speak to her about that. And my daughter, who's 23, said, I don't think she's recently been. Oh, yes, she has. We have the details here. I'll ring her back. Will she be home at 5 o'clock? And I thought, I can't wait, and I'm going to record it. But she didn't ring back. But it'd be good to record some of these things because they're quite aggressive to family members. How dare they? It's extraordinary. Anyway, as we see, there's all sorts of sources now with social media. We're seeing a recruitment through Facebook as well as cold calling. Advertising, we've seen cars parading up and down George Street when you could actually drive down George Street in Sydney with giant billboards on them saying right to drive. You have a right to a luxury vehicle. Just sign here. You don't have to pay a cent, and even spotters. And we have seen particularly targeted in certain ethnic communities where a lady who says, you can refer to me as auntie, magically turns up at accidents in a hijab, as it turns out, and says, I'll do the reporting to the police and everything, and I'll drop round with the forms to your place tonight, and we'll just say I'm your auntie. So extraordinary networks in different communities. So very quickly, am I going over time? Lightning romp through the experience in the UK, which has been horrendous. So by 2010, it was a nightmare. Huge losses in motor. One in seven claims that they could see were linked to these sorts of crash for cash. So some of them were actually staged fraudulent accidents and some of them were exaggerated. And in England, they had a network of claims management companies that seemed to be associated with this farming practice. So they started in 2012 with a new insurance fraud enforcement department within the police that was well-funded, and then followed by some legislative change that started trying to reduce some of the incentives for the small CTP claims. Didn't really prevent it, although it made a dent. Further regulation, so they actually made claims management companies legal and regulated and required certain standards of them in an effort to keep them more ethical. And additional legislative changes around costs and, again, trying to tackle the incentives for minor injury claims. Still not actually really working. They then turned their mind to the cold calling and looked at the telecommunications regulators in terms of what prosecutions could be mounted against the cold calling regimes. And as you see, 180,000 phone lines were disrupted as a result of those investigations. The 500th conviction in 2017 for fraudulent activity around these networks. So extraordinary numbers. And most recently, in June, I think, good old Queen made a speech about, can you believe, about CTP and Mota. Would never have thought Elizabeth would get into it. But I think they were under a great deal of criticism that this legislation had been on the table for a while, and then along came Brexit and an unexpected election and derailed everything. And so the Queen was moved to say, don't worry, we are onto it, and it will happen, and it'll be effective from October 2018, to which everyone went, for God's sake, it's been years. But these are significant reforms to minor injury, both soft tissue and minor psych, in terms of, again, trying to remove the incentives in terms of legal fees, in terms of the amount of compensation that's available. And so it'll be very interesting to watch, once that does come into force, whether that is actually enough to disrupt these networks. But the big worry is that if these networks are disrupted in the UK, are they just going to pack up and go, oh, well, I've made enough money? No, they're going to come to Australia and they're already here. So that's a summary, which I won't go through, of all the efforts in the UK. Here, we've got insurers are aware, but it's very difficult to measure, and getting a handle on the extent of it has been difficult. But the good old ACCC actually did a data collection on complaints that they received about cold calling. So this is just the number of people who actually bothered to pick up the phone and complain to the ACCC. And the numbers were absolutely gobsmacking. We were amazed when we saw it. And it took quite some time to get comparative data over time from the ACCC, because this is not something that they routinely publish. But they happen to have a category of complaint called compensation touting. And so you see, actually, the interesting thing is that it's dropped in New South Wales, arguably because of some of the reforms and a police task force set up in New South Wales, which has probably scared the bejesus out of some of them. But it's just very quickly moved into the other states. Look at the increase in Queensland. And in fact, I think the highest increase is in South Australia and WA, coming from a very low base. So it's really significant activity really quickly. It's interesting how agile they are. And this must be the tip of the iceberg, because this is just the people who bothered to complain. I don't know, what's your guess? One in 10 would complain? One in 20? I don't know. So, I mean, many of us who've received a call, those of you put your hand up, how many reported it to the ACCC? There you go. So it's less than one in 20. Very interesting. Don't need to read all this. I just snatched a few bits from regulator websites, noticing that across all the states, regulators are starting to call it out. Some of them just as a warning, don't get involved in this, don't give your details to any such people. Some of them actually trying to log the calls and keep records of what's being noted in their state. And it's great to see that regulators actually getting involved in asking for the public to report it to them as well and trying to keep records on that. That's not something that they did in New South Wales. So I'm about to hand over to Raj to talk a bit more about the New South Wales situation. But while I do that, I've just got some light entertainment. This is an actual email that has been doing the rounds probably elsewhere, but certainly in New South Wales, two legal firms in New South Wales seeking their business. So the red highlights are mine. So they've got great credentials overseas, which brings us to Australia. Is this too quick to move on? So they're looking to work with solicitors here. The right sort of solicitors. I love this last line, that the agreement that the solicitors are going to sign with you are set up as an internet marketing agreement for compliance purposes, which is code for saying we know it's illegal and you'll be deregistered, but don't worry, we'll hide the money. Extraordinarily blatant. So here's how it works. You can look at this later, but they're basically saying that we've got this fabulous Facebook strategy where we recruit people and vet them, and you get them already vetted so that they're going to be worth your time as a solicitor. They will be making a CTP claim that's got enough in it for you to make some money. And if you want to order an increase of 20 clients a day, we can do that with 24 hours notice. So we're a very agile operation. So what is this vetting? This is direct from their email. So I don't call it vetting, I call it coaching. So they find someone on the internet who's prepared to say that they've been in an accident, whether they have or not, and they tell them that they have to meet these criteria in order to get the money that's in a box with their name on it, as long as they contact this solicitor. So it's pretty blatant and pretty scary, isn't it? I wonder how many of the legal firms that you guys work with have received one of these and what their response was. Anyway, and that I'll hand over to Raj. Thanks.
Yeah, just going back to this vetting slide, I think it's really interesting to see. So this must have been really based on the New South Wales experience at the time, which saw a real increase in psychological claims for really very small psychological claims, essentially, for things like, for children in particular, for things like bedwetting, crying at night. For children. So it's interesting here in this email that you've got the vetting involves psychological damage will significantly enhance the prospects and value of a claim. Sleeping pattern affected, nightmares, anxious when in a car, etc. So I agree with Sue, it sounds very much like email coaching to me. And interestingly, the fees are 30% only if successful. So for the solicitor concerned, there is no risk, particularly if it's used as a marketing tool. We'll come back to the issue of credit hire. So credit hire has been a real growth industry in Australia. And you can see from this chart, on the right-hand graph there, that is Right to Drive, which is owned by Eclipse. It's had an 81% income growth in the year 16 to year 17, 2017. They've expanded to over 30 branches across Australia and New Zealand. 11 branches alone have opened in the last year, and there's plans to go to 40. So it's a real high-growth business. Now, credit hire in and of itself is not illegal whatsoever. It's founded on a common law right, and a lot of these claims actually end up in the small claims court. So it's actually a common law right that they're exploiting. The problem that we see, and this is an injury and disability scheme seminar, not a motor property seminar, the problem that we see in this is that although it's not illegal, and we can see that there's significant growth here and growth potential, the insurers have very limited influence once these people are captured. And our real concern is, where is this data coming from? Where are these referrals coming from? And as Sue mentioned earlier, they might be coming from first responders. It could be the tow truck driver. It is very apparent that a lot of these referrals are coming from motor crash repairers. And that is acknowledged by the companies such as Right to Drive. And they're using this to potentially infiltrate other markets such as CTP. So if you look on the left-hand side, which is probably the more relevant bit for our purposes here, this was the contract that Right to Drive had on their website. Their terms and conditions actually allowed and actually sought consent for their details to be passed on to a CTP legal practitioner. There was a bit of heat about that, particularly in Queensland, and Right to Drive went the Courier Mail and said to the Courier Mail that they deny that they receive any financial incentives from claims relating to personal injuries and will review their terms and conditions. I had a look at their terms and conditions last night, and it has changed. But again, it's very broad. It allows Right to Drive to refer details of an individual onto legal service providers in relation to claims, claims generally, not just motor claims. So it's pretty clear to me that their terms and conditions are broad enough that it seeks to cover off the privacy concerns whilst at the same time ensuring that they're able to refer these matters on. They say not for a financial gain or incentive, but I find that really interesting. As Sue showed in one of those earlier graphs, somebody in this process is making money out of this. Somebody must be getting a referral fee, and if it's not a referral fee, it's disguised as a marketing expense. So we're not saying that what Right to Drive and the operating model is illegal or is wrong. Incidentally, you'd be probably not surprised to learn that the typical cost of a car where Right to Drive, of a car repair bill where Right to Drive is involved, is almost double what it would ordinarily be when a car is insured, you know, by your own insurer. So first party. So Right to Drive claim, third party claim, average motor vehicle repair costs about $8,000, and ordinarily if it's your first party claim, it's about $4,000. So, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in this business model. I'll talk a little bit more about the New South Wales story and give a little bit of background. We've talked about this before, and this information comes from data that we saw at Finity in 2014 and 2015, which really raised some alarm bells to ring. So on the left-hand side, you'll see where the hotspots are. For those that are from Sydney or New South Wales, you can see the red areas. They're the areas where we saw a significant spike in the frequency of particularly small claims that were legally represented. And it just happens to lie in the west, in the southwest, between the M4 and the M5. There was a massive increase in the number of claims between 2014 and 2015 or thereabouts. So what we did, we saw that pattern, we used that as a starting point, and then on the graph on the right, it's deliberately blurry, you don't need to know the details, this is just background. But what we did was, we used a segmentation analysis and used some machine learning algorithms to work out, so where are these claims coming from? What are the claim characteristics that have significantly increased over the last year, 2014, 2015, coming out of the southwest Sydney region? And it was really interesting. And please keep this in mind, because I'll talk about this in the next couple of slides. Some of the biggest segment increases were claimants that were not employed, and particularly claims that had multiple children. So, you know, more than two children in the vehicle per claim. And that's the 285% increase in the dark red that you see on the bottom right there. So this is just a bit of a background to inform some further analysis that we did. This is straying a little bit away from the topic of claim farming, but what it does talk about are the networks and the connections that we were finding. And once you start digging into the networks and the connections, you can then trace things back a little bit further, and with some more sophisticated digging, you might be able to find some of those referral networks. This is a de-identified version that when we used the segments from the previous slide, we found some significant connections between some identities in the personal injury market in CDP in New South Wales. Some of these identities have actually been arrested and charged under Strike Force Ravens, which I'll talk about in a moment. But you can see that there are a lot of connections between medical providers and lawyers. Now, you'll find that ordinarily, but some of these connections were far too strong to be explained in an ordinary way. And, you know, there could be referrals taking place from the lawyer to the medical provider or vice versa. This didn't show that, but what this did show was that there was a really strong connection between an allied health provider and a lawyer, or a doctor and a lawyer. So this sort of information can be very useful when you're trying to find out whether there are networks and connections and whether there are referrals being made. So that leads me to the point, what I'm really trying to talk about is a bit of a history of what's happened since then. So since 2014, 2015, there was a realisation that this was a real problem in New South Wales and something had to be done about it. And part of that was to set up a multi-agency fraud task force, and that was set up in 2016. And at the same time, the police took real interest and got involved. They were part of this multi-agency task force. And as a result, Strike Force Ravens was established. And unlike insurers and unlike regulators, the police have a lot more powers at their disposal, and they're able to access a lot more data than insurers and regulators can. So essentially, and Jeff and I and Sue were having a conversation about this. Jeff's talked to some of the key people from Strike Force Ravens, and one of the key things that they did, and that was probably the key indicator of success, was they followed the money. They followed the money trail like they do, when there's money laundering going on. They followed the money. And when they followed the money trail, they found instances of finding some of these perpetrators involved. And digging further, they found evidence of then things like staged accidents, you know, claims for passengers who were not in the vehicle at the time of the accident, employment and pay records that were clearly fabricated, forgeries and things like that. And since April 2017, when the first arrest was made, as at last week, 17 arrests have now been made, all very heavily publicised in the media and by the regulator and by the police. These 17 arrests have included a solicitor who's, I guess you could say that his law firm experienced triple-digit growth over that three-year period, and he's now arrested. Health practitioners, and not only health practitioners, but those that were purporting to be health practitioners were also arrested. And interestingly, there was an ex-insurance staff member who's now hauled in the net as well, as of last week. There are over 120 charges being laid, fraudulent claims in excess of $11 million in demand. And what they found was there's clearly organised crime networks involved. So I guess from all of that and from the discussion that Sue's just undertaken, we've got to ask the question, has it been successful in New South Wales? Well, I think there are signs that success, it's certainly not fully successful as yet, but it's in train, and we think that there are some indicators of early signs of success. And some of those are, and we can't point to this solely, but certainly claim frequency or reports have come down recently. That's in relation to probably a few things, involving a change to legal costs regulations. But one could also argue that it is as a result of things like Strike Force Ravens. And this is particularly for small claims involving lawyers. And as I said earlier, I wanted you to just keep in mind where those high growth segments were. The biggest drop in the 9 months to 2017 has been from the high growth firms. It's been in relation to children and students. It's about a 1/3 drop. And they're not employed, which has dropped about 18%. So those very segments that were going through the roof have been the ones that have actually come down. What we've also seen is a change in approach and culture in the way that insurers in particular are dealing with these sorts of claims. Insurers are now centralising the management of these claims. They, they're changing their operating model, so they're treating this in a more nuanced way. They're not applying a broad range of indicators to this cohort of claims as they are to the rest of the cohort of claims that they deal with. They are clearly more reluctant to pay go-away money, and they are taking some of these matters on to a tribunal or to court. What's really interesting is that there's been continuing media interest and regulator interest, which has been really important. So what's the moral of the story? I think Sue pointed out pretty clearly that credit hire and claim farming, those operating models, is something that we've inherited from overseas, particularly from the UK, like half of our federal parliament. It's not a good import, but it's certainly, as Sue said, you know, once the work starts to dry up elsewhere, we live in a borderless society. They can easily come to Australia. A lot of these cold callers are known for their foreign accents, so you know, it may be that the call centre is based overseas, in the UK, in the Philippines, in India, or wherever the case may be. They're using opportunistic targeting, but also using organised referral networks involving communities as well. You know, the cold calling business is very agile. As you saw, there was a drop in the number of ACCC complaints for New South Wales. The timing of that is really interesting. But then you saw an exponential growth in other states. We think that it's impacting CTP claims frequency in states which have a fault-based scheme. Credit hire is a fantastic model. I wish I had shares in Right to Drive, because I think, you know, it's got this fantastic way of capturing the client and then holding on to them. So that's clearly impacting motor claims costs and is likely to expand, and we can see a transfer to CTP. Is there an involvement of other professions, legal, medical? We think so. We see the connections. Sometimes it's hard to see the causation, but we see the connections. And one of the more important points is that these referral fees, they are illegal for the legal profession. If not illegal in some states, they're clearly unethical. And the, you know, Law Society rules clearly state that. But it's very easy to disguise that. So that's a problem. So what should the response be, and what are the lessons for Australia? Well, clearly this needs to be a multi-pronged, cross-jurisdictional approach. The problem in Australia, of course, which makes it more vulnerable than the UK, is that we are federated and we don't necessarily work together in one system, whereas in the UK, you know, they can harness their resources in a combined, coherent system to address the problem. For us, you've got to deal with federal versus state, etc. But it's got to be a multi-pronged approach, and it's got to be regulatory. There's got to be education. I think one of the key things in the UK, they've done research there, and I think there's research been done here as well, that ripping off insurers is seen as a bit of a victimless crime. People feel justified in ripping off the banks and insurers. So, you know, there clearly needs to be some education around that. A lot of this stuff has been dealt with on an anecdotal basis and hasn't been given the due attention that having good, solid data would do. So any approach needs to be data-driven, and you clearly have to have the enforcement teeth. Without the police involvement and the enforcement side of things, you're not going to get the results. As I mentioned before, you need to get a whole bunch of players in there, regulators, the ACCC can play a part. The Privacy Commissioner might need to get involved to provide a dispensation. What we see and what we've outlined, the link between credit hire and CTP, for us, that's a bit of a missing link that insurers are probably vulnerable to. The motor business and the CTP business is often run as two distinct silos. So, you know, these players might be cherry picking and utilising that vulnerability. So it's important to try and share that data and share that information that you have with respect to both. And that could inform your claim strategy. But one of the more fundamental things, of course, is you want to make sure that this sort of behaviour is not incentivised. So scheme design in that regard is really fundamental. You need to have a way to deal with small claims and not incentivise the making of small claims and doing that in a way that is potentially fraudulent. Which leads me to the last slide. And that's our key message and key takeaway. It's a bit of a call to arms. It's that the battle is probably just beginning here. These models will become, you know, they are here. They'll become firmly entrenched, if not already. And you need dedicated resources. You need a coordinated response and approach. and you need public education to be part of it. And the final take-home message is we simply cannot be complacent about this, otherwise we'll end up with a strife that the UK has been in for over a decade. Any questions?
Yeah, just a few comments. With the legally represented, it may well be that if the legally represented solicitors and so on who realise that the data is picking up that solicitor X is being involved with all these claims, they might change their strategy. And I think this is being noticed by the insurers that the number of direct, or well, inverted commas, direct claimants is going up to try and defeat our data detection. And another thing was that I think it may well be also that for CTP and workers' comp, there may be commonality that the same service providers and lawyers are acting in both schemes. And if the CTP and workers' comp regulators and insurers don't talk to one another, you know, it might be just be a good exercise to sort of count the number of consultations per doctor and to see physically whether it's in fact possible that that number of people is being seen during a day. I mean, I think that's the Medicare approach. So if you can't get them on something else, at least get them on the number of hours, because there's only 24 hours in a day, and it might be physically impossible that they're actually seeing all these people, and maybe they're just all phantom accounts, but just a few suggestions. Thanks.
I think it's a really good point, Alan. And I think in an ideal world, in Nirvana, you'd have the ability to have access to all the different data sets that might impact this one provider.
There's a chap from New Zealand gave one of the concurrents that was an example of how they had used data in an integrity process, and it was really interesting, and it showed, you know, sort of magic. He said, what did he say? 8 minutes at the computer screen taught them more than 8 months of hard yakka in trying to investigate manually.
It's interesting that what's old is new again. In the 1980s in Victoria, exactly the same set of circumstances existed. The change from the common law to the no fault was able to identify particular ethnic groups in particular suburbs in Melbourne, and it does require concerted effort. And I noticed that the complaints in Victoria are minuscule in comparison. So 30 years later, it's still culturally wrong to go about that pathway. So you need a long-term cohesive approach to prosecute and never ever pay go-away money. And that's a problem for private insurers to say that it's cost too much to defend that particular claim, so I'll pay it away, and then all of a sudden you've got 10,000 of them. So a comment that we've got to learn from history, otherwise we're deemed to repeat it.
Yep. New South Wales exactly the same in the 1980s. GIO was astonished when their number of claims went from 22,000 to 36,000 over a period of about 2 years because they were paying go-away money. Write them a letter, send them 10,000, ring up, that's worth 5,000.
I think you probably answered the question I had, but we'll ask it anyway. To what extent, there are all these other factors, but there's a piece that was always in our control as insurers, to what extent did our unstructured approach to risk offers and file-by-file approach create the opportunity?
I'm not sure that that's what creates the opportunity, Len. The structures are vulnerable all the way through from start to finish. And I don't personally think that insurers broadly, individually or in different segments, have got a lot of culpability on this. But I'm dead concerned that they're not responding in a effective way. I personally fear that the cancer is already here and we may never get rid of it. The detective that runs the New South Wales Task Force, he was a witness at the citizens' jury in Canberra a couple of weeks ago, and he said some fascinating things. He called a spade a bloody shovel, I can tell you that. He said, for example, that they could not have done it without access to phone and bank records. Follow the money, listen to the phone calls. Okay, well, sort of, as soon as you hear it, you get that. None of us can do that. However, nationally, there is a strong mood to use data for crime prevention and crime attack. So there is an environment that's there. Hey, wouldn't it be great if we had motor insurers and all the CTP schemes and a bit from the workers' comp schemes funding the National Anti-Claim Farming Task Force? Because on your own, you can it's like the balloon, you know. You can squeeze it somewhere, go somewhere else, comes back when it can.
All right. Can you please all join me in thanking our authors for a great presentation?